The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books podcast with me, Claire Armitstead. This week's guest is Marlon James, the first ever Jamaican winner of the Man Booker Prize. Here he is accepting his award from jury chairman Michael Wood in one of those edgy continuity moments between a live event and a live broadcast.
The winner of the Man Booker Prize, is that okay for, in terms of timing? The winner of the Man Booker Prize, otherwise I'll sing a couple of songs in my Frank Sinatra imitation. The winner of the prize, the book of this year is Marlon James.
I was so convinced I wasn't going to win, I didn't write a speech. But I did carry a card. Oh, my God. Oh, wow. I just met Ben Okri, and it just hit me how much of my literary sensibility was shaped by the Man Booker Prize. That the Man Booker Prize is that award you hear about that is suddenly increases your library by 13 books. And I remember my great turning point as a writer was when a friend of mine handed me Salman Rushdie's novel, Shame. And I had no idea. I remember reading it and being so appalled by it. Because I grew up in a very sort of British colonial, Dickensian, George Eliot, and I love those writers. And the idea that those things were possible in fiction just never occurred to me. But that just added to the sort of Booker sort of mythology. The Booker was that thing you hear about, and it shapes your writing, it shapes your thinking.
We lured Marlon into the studio just before the prize was announced to tell us about his extraordinary and controversial novel set around the attempted assassination of Bob Marley in 1976. We'll also be talking to Guardian arts journalist Paula Kokotza, who had the mammoth task of reading all six shortlisted books in preparation for the big event. But first, here's Marlon reading an excerpt from his novel, A Brief History of Seven Killings. We meet Bam Bam as he describes a childhood in the ghetto and introduces us to Bob Marley, known throughout the book as the singer, someone who is different, who is to be envied, who has sung himself out of the ghetto.
Is he who fights and run away, live to fight another day?
Two men bring guns to the ghetto. One man showed me how to use it. But ghetto people used to kill each other long before that, with anything we could find. Stick, machete, knife, ice pick, soda bottle. Kill for food, kill for money. Sometimes a man get killed because he look at another man in a way that he didn't like. And killing don't need no reason. This is ghetto. Reason is for rich people. We have madness. Madness is walking up a good street downtown and seeing a woman dress up in the latest fashion and wanting to go straight up to her and grab her bag, knowing that it's not the bag or the money that we want so much, but the scream. When she see that, you jump right into her pretty face and you could slap the happy right out of her mouth and punch the joy right out of her eye and kill her right there and rape her before or after you kill her. Because that is what rude boys like we do to decent women like her. Madness that make you follow a man in a suit down King Street, where poor people never go, and watch him throw away a sandwich, chicken, you smell it, and wonder how people can be so rich that they use a chicken for just to put out between so-so bread, and you pass the garbage and see it, still in the foil, and still fresh, not brown with the other garbage, and no fly on it yet, and you think maybe, and you think yes, and you think you have to, just to see what chicken tastes like with no bone. But you say, you're not no madman, and the madness in you is not crazy people madness, but angry madness. Because you know the man threw it away because he want you to see. And you promise yourself that one day, rude boy going to start walking with a knife, and next time, I going jump in and carve sufferer right in him chest. But you know boy like me can't walk downtown for long before we get pounced on by Babylon. Police only have to say that me don't have no shoes before he say, what the blood clot you nasty niggas doing around decent people, and give me two choices. Run, and he give chase into one of them lanes that cut through the city so that he can shoot me in private. Plenty shots in the magazine, so at least one bullet must hit. or stand down and get beat up right in front of decent people. Him swinging the baton and knocking out my side teeth and cracking my temple so that I can never hear good out of that ear again. And saying, let that be a lesson to never take a dirty, stinking ghetto self uptown again. And I see them and I wait. But then you come back, even though nobody know when you leave. Woman want to know, why you come back when you can always get nice things like Uncle Ben's rice in America? We wonder if you go there to sing hit songs. Some of we keep watching as you shift through the ghetto like small fish in a big river. Me know your game now, but didn't see it then. How you friend up the gunman here, the rasta with the big sound there, and this bad man, and that rude boy, and even my father, so that everybody know you enough to like you, but not enough to remember to recruit you. You sing just about anything, anything to get a hit, even stuff that you alone know and nobody else care about. And I love her because Prince Buster cover You Won't See Me and get himself a hit. You use what you have, even a melody that's not yours, and you sing it hard and sing it long and sing yourself straight out of the ghetto. By 1971, you already on TV. By 1971, I shoot my first shot. I was 10.
That is our first introduction to Bam Bam, who's mm-hmm. one of, I think, 76 characters, speaking characters.
I've lost count.
I counted. And the person he's talking about is Bob Marley.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about this history. This goes back 5 years before the central event of this novel.
Yeah, it goes back before, because Bam Bam in particular has been watching the evolution of Marley. There are quite a few Bam Bams. And there's the character later in the book, his name is, I think, Tristan Phillips, who's another form of Bam Bam. All these men who came, boys really, who came from the same background as Marley but didn't end up where he did. And Bam Bam and this character both end up being gunmen. But it was, they could have so easily, maybe just a different spot of luck, and they would have ended up somewhere else. So he sees that and he's very bitter. He's very vicious. He internalizes all that anger, and Marley becomes the focus because he knows in a lot of ways he's no different. So why did this person end up here and he end up down there? And he has no answers for it.
At the very center of the novel is this attempted assassination of Marley. Tell us a bit about that. Is that something that means a lot to Jamaicans?
It does mean a lot to Jamaicans, the assassination attempt. It was December. It was the end of the year. It was the second to last major event to happen that year. After that came the elections and all hell broke loose. It was a very traumatic year. There's so many things that happened. The year began with a mass poisoning. Contaminated flour got into Jamaica and people were dropping down dead everywhere. At some point, the ambassador to Peru was murdered. At one point, Henry Kissinger was in the island to make sure Jamaica didn't support Cuba in Angola. There were all these things happening, and the Marley assassination became the climax. In a bigger scheme, it's one of these things that seems so surprising yet so inevitable. Things were going so badly, something had to explode. It's just that nobody thought it would have been that. Until it happened, nobody would have thought of it happening. Marley's house was sort of sacred ground, and Marley was one of the few men in Jamaica who was supposed to be untouchable. So of all the things we expect to explode in 1976, that was the one thing nobody would have ever guessed.
But he was about to do a concert, which was mm-hmm. Commissioned by Manley.
Yeah, it wasn't really... Sort of, Marley had an idea of this sort of non-partisan concert, and Marley agreed to it as long as it was impartial, it was non-partisan. And the party, as soon as he agreed to it and everything was set in stone, the party then jumped on it, and it became seen as this PNP event that Marley
endorsed. This is the People's National Party.
People's National Party that Marley endorsed, and that wasn't it at all. But it did become a political event, even though that the whole point to it was to transcend politics and sort of foster this peace, because everybody knew the general election was coming and everybody knew it was going to be bloody. And this was almost a last-ditch attempt to bring some peace. But you know, as some characters say in the book, good times are bad times for somebody, and bad times are good times for someone. So it was in the interest of pretty much all politics that election wasn't peaceful.
And there's a lot that seven has a big significance to you in this book, doesn't it? I mean, interestingly, you were seven when this happened, weren't you? It was six or seven.
I was six.
You were six.
Six. Seven, yeah, it's funny. In a lot of ways, 1976 was considered, for a lot of Rastafarians, 1976 was a year before 1977. And 1977 was when Two Sevens clash, which is also a great reggae song. So there was a lot of ill feeling, a lot of foreboding about that. The other reason why Seven Killings is that one of the killers, killer number eight, went and confessed to Marley and redeemed himself, even became a part of Marley's posse. So of the eight, seven, you know, the seven met their fates pretty brutally.
So we know that there were seven people who were set out to assassinate.
Well, no, there were only seven. I don't know if the exact figure, because in the book, what people forget, even though it says seven killings, is actually have eight people storm his house. So killer number eight. Well, killer number eight wasn't killed right afterwards, and you know, he certainly had some guts to go and, you know, beg forgiveness. But other than that, you know, we Jamaicans, we're big on symbols. We're big on symbols. We're big on signs and wonders. We're big on anything that seems prophetic. Even the 56 bullets, you know, became significant because some Rastafarian says whoever killed him will die from 56 bullets. And then somebody ended up dying for 56 bullets, but I don't think he had nothing to do with the killing. But we're still very superstitious.
You change the names. You don't actually refer to Marley as Marley. He's the singer all the way through. Why do you do that? And you invent a name for a ghetto.
Yeah. One main reason being that as a novelist, I think I still reserve the right to invent and create. Because I wasn't trying to write nonfiction. I wasn't trying to write In Cold Blood or any form of nonfiction. I've still sort of reserved the right to be kind of fanciful with it. I'd say a more, for want of a better word, artistic reason is that I'm still hugely inspired by Greek tragedy and Greek drama and poetry. And I like how they sometimes spring for allegory when it comes to naming. Copenhagen City, anybody who knows their work would know Tivoli Gardens is in Denmark.
So and Tivoli Gardens is the real life ghetto that Copenhagen is
based on. And people eventually they figured it out. As for calling Marley the singer, my experience of Marley and most people's experience of Marley is not a physical person. It's the icon on TV. It's the sound on the radio. It's the record that every male in a college dorm listens to in America. So we don't have a physical experience of him, and I wanted that Marley because that's the one I know and that's the one I grew up with. I never met him, and the singer it becomes a kind of allegory when you think Jamaica and singer. He's the first person, for a lot of us, the only person whose name comes up. So I wanted him to, even back in 1976, Marley was an icon. He was almost more of a legend than a person. And I wanted to stick to that impression.
That is the central event. But then you move forward. So you sort of trace the shockwaves that go forward from the event and forward and outward, because it's not just set in Jamaica either, is it?
I mean, it ends in the Bronx. It goes into New York. Nobody's more surprised at that than I am, because I had not intended for the novel to have, or rather, I'd not intended that event to have such an afterlife. And a lot of it comes from doing the research and tracing the people who were allegedly involved and what it led to. But even without that, at the end of the 70s, a lot of these gunmen, like the men in the book, all fled the country. Some because their party was no longer in power, some because their party no longer needed them. You know, we're in power, we don't need you. Some because they were wooed by the Medellin drug cartel. So for whatever reason, these guys were going abroad anyway. And I never knew, I sort of knew about it, but I didn't think about it until I started writing this novel and realizing that a lot of these guys, including the Seven, had these afterlives where they became central parts of the crack trade in the 80s. And part of it too is also, as a novelist, I think you start to fall for your characters. And I really want to see where they ended up. I could have left it in 1979 and called it the end of the novel. But I was really interested in the afterlives of these characters. Where do they go? If somebody is on the run because they're just afraid for their lives, how does that person live 5 years? How do they live 10? Do they ever get over it? Or does it, even without them knowing it, does it shape their lives? That character, Nina Burgess, ends up taking on these assumed names over and over. She never can go back to who she was.
She's somebody who has an affair with Marley back in 1976.
She claims she did.
She claims she had a one-night stand. He's written a song after her.
I know at least two other women who claims that song is about them. So she claims it is. But yeah, she gets so unmoored by an event that she's not even a part of. And the consequences carry her straight into nearly 20 years. It completely shapes how she lives. She loses her identity. She loses herself in an event she was not a part of.
Did you meet people who are involved in this in any way? I mean, when you talk about research, how did your research manifest itself?
Well, a lot of my research was not necessarily about these men in particular, because there's a lot we don't know. One of the reasons why I wrote the novel is because of things we'll never know, and I wanted to reconstruct. But in terms of research, even though I was pretty young, I grew up in the 70s, and I certainly grew up in the 80s. So a lot of this I was aware of. Jamaica is still a small country, and we talk about everything, or we have rumors about everything. At the same time, you know, I spoke to a lot of people who came from these communities. A lot of the, funny enough, 1979 in that book, pretty much none of that came from research. All that came from people who were with Marley, people who were directly or indirectly connected, people who lived in those neighborhoods. A scene that was harrowing to write, and I think it's Bam Bam talks about it. Oh, if you're in a ghetto area, you start out the day standing upright, and by the time you reach the night, you're crawling on your belly, because that's when the bullets start flying. And it's become so matter of fact, people even realize that they're getting progressively shorter as the day moves through. That's something you hear from people who live there. So and I was really sort of attuned to that. So and just because I knew something didn't mean I wouldn't research it. But a lot of the research stuff was actually fun stuff, like what was American slang in the 70s.
You have a great Rolling Stone journalist who's sort of too cool for school.
Yeah, he thinks he's too cool for school, but he's from the Midwest, and I live in the Midwest now. They're not cool. But he's also really self-conscious and really, like a lot of Midwesterners, really concerned about being perceived as a hick. So he overcompensates. A character in there once said, I think a character in there says, "Stop speaking jive, you're from Minnesota." And he becomes really self-conscious. And that was, you know, I do a lot of inconsequential sort of trivial research. Like I will build glossaries. This is the second novel where I've built a dictionary of how people spoke. Because you can't get the decades right. When was gnarly? When was spaz? Did we use cool throughout the whole thing? But even in a very, very subtle way, our cultural cues shifted from the UK to the US in the 70s. Which is one of the reasons why I can tell when somebody, their reggae coming of age was being in the UK as opposed to being in Jamaica. It really is two different sensibilities. And I wanted to be sort of conscious of that as well. There's a part in it where somebody pointed out, if you were a Rastafarian in the UK, in London, in England in the 70s, you didn't want to go to Ethiopia. Your homeland was Jamaica. You wanted to come back. And that's a profound difference between Rastas who grew up in the British diaspora and Raspas who stayed home. they had two different ideas of where they want to end up. So being conscious of that, and that's the stuff that you can only learn when you sort of widen the idea of research.
Are you a Rastafarian?
No, I just love the hair. I'm not even joking. No, I'm not. I have a huge respect for it, particularly that Rastafarianism and with reggae as its vehicle became the first. It's not a first. Well, it sort of was a first vehicle for expressing really complex emotions using Jamaican patois. Because before that, Jamaican patois meant slapstick comedy. It meant something you laugh at. Even when it was being sly, it was still this kind of only in the guise of humor. So when Bob Marley comes up with a song like Johnny Was, when he's lamenting the aftermath of violence, it never occurred to us that the voice that came out of our own mouths could speak about things so complicated. So that the writers such as myself owe enormous debt to Rastafarianism and to reggae.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you've got many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands, and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, head to squarespace.com/guardian. One of the things that you do is you not only have 75 voices, but mm-hmm. some of the voices change during the course of a monologue. So, for example, mm-hmm. your CIA men are sort of ducking and diving out of different slangs because mm-hmm. they're trying to pass themselves off as different communities.
Yeah. And that came out of because I have a very sort of geekish fascination with language and how we use it, how we manipulate it, how we use it in front of different people, what we're trying to hide, what we're trying to show, when we're trying to blend in. And there's also an obsession, particularly with the Jamaican characters, with proper speech. Even though by their standards, none of them are speaking it. But they always talk about that person who chats bad, which is something that still happens in Jamaica. We have a very Victorian mode of standard English, which we think is really proper, which even British people laugh at. But the other thing about language, and I know it from personal experience, is that language is how I code switch. So the language that I'm speaking now will not be the language I speak to my cousin later on. And the language I speak to my cousin, which is a kind of Jamaican patois, is not the Jamaican patois I'm going to speak back in Kingston. And when I go back to the States, I go back to saying things like water, which none of us here can spell because we say water. So I wanted to catch that code switching that happens. And I actually think ultimately it recognizes the dynamics of language. That language is always changing, it's always evolving, and it always serves a purpose. Sometimes not a good one, but it's always serving something.
This is a very macho novel in some mm-hmm. ways, but you have Nina, we've mentioned before, is a very strong character in it. Mm-hmm. You have, it's macho, but you manage to find a voice and a place for women in it.
Yeah. It's funny, there was a time I actually thought that this was the man novel because I just wrote an all-female novel before. I'm like, all right. And I even got some flack that you have no three-dimensional men in your last novel. I'm like,
that was the Book of Night
Women. So because I didn't care. So, it's not a contest to get representation. And this one was sort of male-heavy. But Nina is one of, I think, only two characters that make it all the way to the end. And she's a survivor, and one of the things she is surviving is the mistreatment, the poor treatment, the sometimes outright brutality of men towards her. And that was very, very important to me, that sometimes the most miraculous thing that certainly a woman in the 70s could do is just survive it.
That until they're no longer first class and second class citizens of any nation.
And that's what she became really, really important. Again, because she's the only main character who's female. Because it really is a story to a huge extent of men doing bad things to each other. But the blowback, the fallback, the fallout always hits other people. And she was perfect for showing that.
You've been likened, it's been likened to Tarantino, it's been likened to Oliver Stone. Mm-hmm. Did you expect that?
No, especially since writers like being compared to other writers. I'm like, couldn't you say Melville? Give me a great dead
or
writer.
Or some classical writer.
Some classic writer, preferably dead. No, but to an extent it makes sense because I'm hugely inspired by cinema. Almost as much as I am by books. When I'm teaching creative writing, I have to remind myself that my past five examples were all film, and this is a writing class. So I'm hugely inspired by cinema, and I've learned a lot from it, including just how to have really, really pungent sensory details to the point where I don't have to necessarily use a metaphor or so on, especially with this book, because this book is told by a lot of really ordinary, and I use ordinary loosely, but really ordinary people. They don't have pretty metaphors. They can't string a literary device. They wouldn't. So what do they use? How do we make it vivid? And cinema is a great help in that regard. One of the great things about cinema, one thing that cinema reminds me is you have to find a resonance in the scene as it is. I tell my students, a sunset doesn't need your help. Just describe it. It can be gorgeous all on its own. Blood doesn't need help. Sex doesn't need help. Violence really doesn't need help. You really just get in like a reporter and get out. In retrospect, that's probably why my US editor is actually a nonfiction editor, because I wanted that type of brevity and that type of using the actual scene, and the scene itself should have that resonance that you kind of have to do with nonfiction and journalism.
And there is a sort of visceralness, isn't there? You have Alex Pierce, who's your Rolling Stone journalist,
right,
saying that a ghetto is like a smell. Mm-hmm. Is a smell, in fact.
It is. It is very visceral. Again, I actually didn't set out to write such a sensory kind of novel, because I like my devices and innuendos and all these things as much as anybody else. But particularly something like the ghetto, the visuals are too easy, and the visuals can lie to you. Smell conjures memory. Smell conjures mood. And the idea that you can recognize a place, you can tag a place by the different progression of smells. I remember one of the writers that influenced me with that was actually Margaret Atwood in Cat's Eye, where she'd have a scene where, since I'm in the UK, I would say lift instead of elevator, where the lift is going up and each level there's a different smell until she gets to, says, the scent of formaldehyde and snakes. That sort of sensory deprivation. Azir Nafisi in Reading Lolita in Tehran, she uses sound. So there's an explosion, but you hear it and you feel the ground shake. And that type of denying a sense sometimes heightens the tension. So the whole idea of, it's not just that I'm giving you ghetto as a series of smells. I'm not telling you what it looks like. So you are being blindfolded and taken into somewhere where that's all I'm giving you. So it's not just a sensory overload of smell, but it's the fact that the rest of it is being denied to you. It forces a different way of seeing something, which those are the writers I got that from.
This is your third novel, mm-hmm. and you arrive on the shortlist of the Booker Prize. Mm-hmm. How did it feel to you to get here? Were you surprised?
I was surprised. It's for the reason that the Booker Prize is that thing you hear about, is that thing you read, is that thing that informs your reading taste from as ever since I could remember. You know, it's one of those things you just don't think of happening to you. You just think, oh, soon I'll get five new books I'm going to read. You know, when I think of Booker, I think of Alan Hollinghurst, I think of Nadine Gordimer, I think of J.M. Coetzee, these writers who maybe I've gotten to them eventually, but I got to them through the Booker Prize. So I look at it as this type of amazing phenomena that contributes to the shaping of my literary sensibilities. I don't look at it as something that I get shortlisted for. So it's kind of surreal, and it will be we're looking at next year's shortlist and seeing on the website 2015 shortlist and see my name there and still wondering, how the hell did I get there?
So you suddenly find yourself in this company of people that you've been reading as an academic and as well as a writer.
As an academic and just as a young writer, I remember reading The Conservationist. I remember that the only reason I read Life of Pi was because it won the Booker and I hadn't heard of it. It's kind of strange. It's really surreal.
Lots of interesting stuff there from Marlon. With me here in the studio is Paula Kokotza, who interviewed him immediately after his win. Paula, you had to mug up on all six contenders. This is sort of one of the showpiece literary events of the year. It's a Herculean journalistic challenge for literary journalists.
It was. I mean, I think I had 9 days and I counted six books and about 2,800 pages. So I was setting myself a pace of about a page a minute, and it was 9 days of fairly solid reading. And it was a thrill. I'm so pleased that A Brief History of Seven Killings won. I think this book stood out from the first page. The voice of the first character, Sir Arthur George Jennings, is so striking. He says, "Dead people never stop talking. Dead, it sounds final, but it's a word missing an ing." And that sense of being immersed in one brilliant voice after another, I just loved.
Did you mind the violence?
I didn't. I actually have quite a low tolerance of violence, so I was worried about it, but it didn't feel bad. I thought there were lots of types of violence, and the worst types felt kind of necessarily awful and appalling and shocking, and that was right, and that was what the book needed in those moments. But there were also moments where the violence, I hesitate to say enjoyable, but where it was felt more like violence out of a comic or violence out of Tarantino, where a character carries out a hit and then complains about the mess on his Starsky and Hutch T-shirt, for example.
That's very Tarantino, isn't it?
Yeah, and so there were those moments where I don't think it was letting off the reader, but there was a scale of discomfort with the violence, and that felt appropriate, and it really worked, I thought.
A lot of fuss has been made about the fact that one of the gangsters is gay, and indeed Marlon James himself is gay.
Yeah, well, when I interviewed him, I thought it was really interesting. He said he started with one character. You know, there's 76 characters, I think, in the cast list. He started with only one, and I would never have guessed that one was John Kay, this sort of, who has only a few chapters and only two-thirds of the way in. He's kind of absent for the first two-thirds. So it's amazing to think this book started there, but I think that really tells you about how important those issues were to James, that was his beginning, really. And I think the homosexuality in the first part of the book, when the story's set in Jamaica, feels very violent.
It's about people being brutalised, isn't it?
Brutalised or degraded, and it's referred to often as something that takes place in prison. So the idea that this sort of sexual fluidity or sexual freedom really comes about when the novel shifts to New York. And I think that's really interesting, that was where it began.
Some people have said it's hard to read, it's uncompromising, and it's very long.
It's very long. It's nearly
dense.
It's dense. It was hard to read in places. It's not an easy read. And I think James himself said in his speech after he received the award that he's not an easy novelist in lots of ways. And there are times where you really have to pick the action out, pick the plot out of all the action or the reminiscence and just the sort of digressions as well, really. I remember thinking that when one character says, right, in 24 hours we're going to the singer's house, you know, and that the assassination attempt is going to take place, and then it's kind of nearly 200 pages later that you actually get that piece of action. So you definitely have this sense of reading being a labour, an exertion, and you really have to work to kind of find out what's going on a lot of the time. But I think that's the beauty of it as well. And that's what makes it so extraordinary and so impressive.
all the characters, there's a dramatist personae, all the 76 characters at the beginning. Did you find you were having to go back and refer to it?
I did, all the time. And I thought that was quite clever, actually, because in the book, you're literally flipping backwards and forwards. And I think he does mess with chronology. And there are kind of little, as I say, and digressions and reminiscences that throw you back further in time than you thought you were. I remember thinking at one point a character almost seems to die twice, and it's sometimes that feels a bit cinematic, like he's rewinding and replaying. And other times I think it's just making you work. It's a bit of a sort of a reading workout session in a way.
And that the dramatist persona tells you where they're from and what era they're from as well.
So yes.
That you have that double reference.
Yeah, and there's a couple of, not red herrings, but there's a couple of little puzzles in that cast list as well, I think.
Did you enjoy it, the million-dollar question?
I loved it. I loved it. Every now and then I'd say aloud, this is really difficult. But equally often, I just wanted to stand up and read aloud from it. I think it's got that amazing spoken voice that you hear while you're reading the words on the page. And I'm already looking forward to his next novel, which he did tell me was going to be big and that it's set in the 1100s. So that sounds quite intriguing.
A very big change from this one.
Yeah.
Well, Paula, thank you very much. And thank you also to Marlon James. And I'm afraid that's all we have time for today. We'd love to hear what you think. A Brief History of Seven Killings is published by One World, or you can get it from the Guardian Bookshop as part of a special Booker Prize deal. We'll be back next week. Until then, from me, Claire Armistead, and my producer, Susanna Tresilian, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.